I know when we hear this story, and I don't know when the last time this was read here at Bethel, but when we hear it, we kind of cringe a little bit. You know, at the end of a story like this, you wish Jesus would say, you know, JK, LOL, just kidding. I really don't mean that. Because deep down, we don't really want to talk about heaven and hell. I mean, it's not necessarily the story itself, because it is a story that Jesus tells, but it's the realities that Jesus points to. I mean, we're okay with heaven. We like talking about heaven. That's good. We like that. Matter of fact, we like it so much that some theologians have decided that everyone gets to go. But then there are others who have such a strong dislike for hell that they've declared it null and void, that good theologians, in quotes, have reasoned hell out of existence. I mean, what's not to like with good theology, right? That hell has gone out of business, everyone gets to go to heaven. Sounds like a great resolution to the afterlife to me. I mean, I am glad that humans have figured everything out and have set Jesus straight. Clearly, Jesus, the Son of God, was confused telling a story like this that goes against what theologians have decided. Silly Jesus. But here's the thing. The stakes are really high when it comes to stories like this. And here's the thing. That's not even the main point of the story, but it comes with so much baggage that I have to unpack it before we even get into what the story's about. Heaven and hell aren't even the main concerns, because most of the people, if not all the people that Jesus was talking to in Luke 16, already accepted everything that Jesus was talking about, except for the very end. These realities weren't up for discussion. Everybody accepted them, except for this small sect called the Sadducees who didn't believe in any afterlife. But everybody else that Jesus was talking to, they believed in this. Not so much today. Yet when Christians start talking about the non-existence of hell, what do you do with a story that comes straight from the lips of Jesus? Clearly, choices have to be made. Either Jesus is making this stuff up and he's not worthy of our devotion, or he is telling us a truth about a reality which none of us can see. And if we want to jump on the train of not believing in the words of Jesus, then we have to discount his words too. And if we disregard his teachings, what comes next? On top of that, who gets to decide? Do we become like Thomas Jefferson, who edited the Bible and cut out the things with the razor blade, the things that he didn't find believable? Yes, there is a Jefferson Bible. We are forced into a place of thinking about this, possibly even making a choice. We can't ignore it. It's right here in front of us. Do we take Jesus at his word? Or do we line up with well-meaning theologians who tells us there's no hell because of a well-reasoned argument? That is what is at stake when stories like this are read and dismissed, because honestly, we just don't like the reality that Jesus is talking about. And it becomes a slippery slope, because who gets to do the picking and choosing, and where does it end? And I'll actually tell you where it ends. It ends this way. We start with, I don't like that, and we discount that, and I got a good argument of why that doesn't work. And eventually we get to the point, believe it or not, of you don't really need a resurrection for God to forgive. You don't really need that. And then from there it goes to, well, God is just really this big fluffy grandfather type who lets his kids do whatever they want, and it's okay. That's what you descend into when we start discounting the words of Jesus. I mean, is it possible that Christ is talking from a place of experience being the creator of all? I'm just throwing that out there. Jesus tells a story to make a point, And it's not even about heaven and hell, but it is so loaded with baggage that we have to face that stuff first. So what I want you to be thinking about is things I just talked about. Is this worthy of paying attention to? Are there truths in here that we need not dismiss? And if so, where do we stop dismissing things when it comes to the words of Jesus? Okay? So let's dig in a little bit on the story. The story is a story of extremes. Someone once even wanted to argue with me that the fact that this was a historical, actual thing that happened as opposed to Jesus telling a story, which if you just go back and read, you can see it's all in quotes and he's telling a story, kind of like a parable. But no matter how I tried to say that that Jesus was telling a story to make a point, this person wouldn't listen to me, but that's okay. But I will tell you that the truths contained within the story are very real and very important. And like I said, it's a story of extremes where there's a really rich guy and a really poor guy. Jesus names the poor guy, but he doesn't name the rich guy. The poor guy's name is Lazarus, and guess where Jesus wants us to focus? He wants us to focus on this guy named Lazarus. And no, it's not the same one that Jesus rose from the dead in the Gospel of John, the brother of Mary and Martha who live in Bethany. Lazarus was a common name, as a matter of fact. It's a Greek version of the name Eliezer, which means whom God has helped, which kind of helps us in the story here, that we see that God is coming to the aid of this guy named Lazarus. Now it says the rich guy wears purple. Purple was a rare color in clothes back then, which made it very expensive because the dye came from a certain type of sea snail. So to make something called Tyrian purple, they'd have to harvest these marine sea snails that were collected by the thousands. They'd have to boil them in lead vats. And out of that, a chemical reaction would take place because the snails weren't purple. Through the lead, the heat, the light, the snails, boom, you get purple dye. That's an extra. I'm not charging extra for that, just so you know. Matter of fact, they did this for so long that synthetic purple dye did not come into effect until 1850, when a scientist was trying to create synthetic quinine to fight malaria. He did not do that, but he figured out a way to make purple dye. So how about that? Anyways, I got tied up in my research. It happens. I don't even know. Do I have anywhere to go? I don't know. Maybe that's it. So this guy's wearing purple. So he's rich. And Lazarus was so poor, he couldn't cover the sores on his body that the dogs would lick. A story of contrasts. But Lazarus laid by the gates of this rich man's house. He wasn't like somewhere in town that he might occasionally pass by. He was right there at this guy's gates. So the rich man could not pass by without seeing him. All the poor man wanted was food off the table, like the crumbs of the table, just to eat. And it's pretty clear that this rich man turned a blind eye and did nothing for Lazarus. So this is a story in three scenes. That's the first scene, kind of set the stage of what's going on. So this is what happens in scene two. First, Lazarus dies. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. Now, what I find fascinating about this, and maybe you won't, but I do, is that this is a direct view into Jesus' time and how people viewed the afterlife. Some of you might have heard growing up a term called the bosom of Abraham. And some of you are giving me blank stares. But anyways, there was something called the bosom of Abraham. Matter of fact, there was a Sunday school song with the lyrics, you know, the bosom of Abraham. And we'd all sing it and we'd giggle because we had no idea what it meant. But this is what it meant. When people died, they believed in Jewish times, of Jesus' time and before, that Father Abraham was with God. And that Father Abraham was the patriarchal father of all Israel. In that certain people, that God would intercede at their death and bring that person through the angels to Father Abraham. And the imagery here is that they would rest essentially on Father Abraham's lap and kind of fall asleep on his chest in a way that a child would sit on a parent's lap and kind of be rocked to sleep. So it kind of gives a meaning to eternal rest. And here's a carving, and I know it's kind of hard to see, but it's Father Abraham with kind of children, looks like to be a hammock, but kind of resting on his chest. So heaven being a place of eternal rest, it makes sense that the patriarch of all Israel, Abraham, would be there. But it's even more than that. It's kind of multi-layered. That in ancient times, when there was a dinner party, the person of honor at that dinner party would sit next to the host of the party, so close that they would probably rub elbows as they were having dinner. And they didn't sit at tables like we sat at. They were more like reclined. So they'd be on pillows, and they'd be kind of leaning and rubbing elbows, but possibly even so close, the imagery here, as to be close enough to lean on one person's chest. So the imagery was common. I mean, this is what everybody kind of held belief about heaven, that God would intercede and bring them up to Father Abraham so that they could find eternal rest. And that is that kind of the hallmark of heaven is community, a place where people are kind of caring for each other, and the image of a heavenly banquet. I mean, even Jesus talks about a heavenly banquet. Imagine a church potluck times like a million times better. And that people would find rest and community, and the people you're with God, celebrating and laughing and enjoying each other, and all the sadness and pain we've ever experienced in this life is wiped away. Matter of fact, the thing that's stressing you out right now the most, one day it will be gone. Being reunited with loved ones, all of that plays into this of what is happening to Lazarus. Never being tired or hungry or sick or worried or angry or upset or anxious. Or for Lazarus, having dogs lick your open wounds. So that's what's going on with him. Now here's the contrast to that. The rich man also died and was buried. The end. Like what? Like we got all that and nothing? But what does it tell us? There's a lot of subtext going on here, right? This is the subtext, is that God intercedes for Lazarus, but does not intercede for the rich man. Jesus is pointing out to us in this story that this is the norm, that people die and they are buried. That's what happens. What is unusual is that God intercedes and brings someone up to heaven with Father Abraham. So let's say it a different way. What happens to the rich man is the supernatural course of things for most people. Which might be another way of saying God doesn't send anyone to hell. People do that on their own. Now, when Jesus tells this story, remember, everyone believes in God because they're all Jewish, including the characters of the story. There is no, well, the believers are good and they go to heaven and the unbelievers are bad and they're going to hell. There's none of that. Everyone believes here. And that's the end of scene two. So we finally have the final act. Another contrast of extremes. We have the rich man, as we know, in Hades or hell, and Lazarus in heaven. The rich man realizes his fate, and notice what he does not do. He doesn't try to change it. He doesn't appeal. He doesn't say not fair. He just accepts it. It's Jesus' story, right? He knows it. It is what it is. He knows why he's there, even though it is unsaid. But he does ask for a favor. Father Abraham, send Lazarus down with a drop of water for my tongue. And he says to him, look, son, remember that in your lifetime you received good things while Lazarus received bad things. But now he's comforted. He's comforted here and you are in agony. There is compassion in the response of Father Abraham. He calls him son. Not unlike the father and son in the prodigal son story in Luke 15. He says, look, I have compassion on you, but you already received the good things. And the subtext is, and you didn't share them. And conversely, Lazarus didn't get anything good, and now he's receiving some good stuff, which to me kind of sparks off the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they will inherit the kingdom of heaven. Now, if the story ended right here, if it ended right here, you'd say this story's all about earning your way into heaven. If you are poor, well, you got a fighting chance. But if you're rich and you don't share, well, you're in big trouble. But that is not the end of the story. Matter of fact, we keep going. We finally get to the point that Jesus is trying to make. So the rich man makes another appeal. And this is where we kind of get to the heart of it. Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so they will not also come to this place of torment. It's like, okay, so I can't have water because there's this chasm between heaven and hell. How about this? You send Lazarus back and warn them so they don't end up like me. Fair request, right? Love my family. Don't want this to happen to them. And he says, look, Abraham says, look, they have Moses and the prophets. That should be enough. Let them listen to them. I mean, everything you need is in the book. You know, it's all there. You have the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. It's all there. It's valuable. That's all they need. That's all you needed. And he says, no, no, no. If someone rises from the dead and goes to him, they will repent. They will change. You see, Abraham, the rich man says, the book isn't good enough for us. We need a personal invitation. We need something more. And this is Abraham's response. If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, in other words, if they don't read the book, if they don't read the bestseller, they will not even be convinced if someone rises from the dead. So Jesus gets to the point of the story. He's talking about himself while instructing us about a bunch of other things. And so here we are today. Some things haven't changed. For some folks, the Bible is not enough, and neither is a guy rising from the dead. It's funny. What was true back then is still true today. And here's the thing. Even if one never sets foot in a church, there's no judgment in that. Paul, who wrote so many letters that are included in the New Testament, says that there are signs that point you toward the conclusion that there may be a God who's responsible for a lot of stuff in our world, which should move you to maybe investigate this. Matter of fact, in Romans 1, it says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, creation, so that people are without excuse. So he says that God leaves signs like sunsets and sunrises and mountains and oceans and other things that take your breath away. And yet the church is here. And we have been called and gathered and sent out to be ready to share when people say, is there more to life than just me? That's why we've been gathered. And the good news of this story of Lazarus and the rich man, which has all sorts of baggage with it, is this. We don't have to wonder if we're the rich man or Lazarus and wondering if will God intercede on our behalf at the end of all things. No. You see, God has already decisively acted in the death and resurrection of Jesus. There's no second guessing and wondering, am I going to make it to heaven at the end? Are the angels going to show up when I need it? That issue has already been decided, and it's even more important because sometimes we are the rich man. Sometimes we are the rich man in this story, but his fate is not our fate. Because Christ has transformed us from the rich man into Lazarus, that whom God has helped. God has moved us from being self-reliant and respectable in the world into a beggar who relies fully on God. That is the good news for us. But it's also a reminder. This story serves as a reminder And it points to our core values of responding to needs and generosity as well. That when we see a need out in the world, that we should respond to it and make a difference, to keep our eyes open because there is need all around us. And I leave you with this, is that we should be Jesus until we see Jesus. Amen.